Thank you, everyone, for being here. I might sneeze a little, just for fun. Frank and I are so... What? Maybe. We'll see if I get very enthusiastic. Frank and I are...
It's sacred bacteria.
Yeah, the sacred feminine. Frank and I are delighted to be back here. We were here on Easter Sunday and talked about transformation. There was a lot of hoopla because it was being videotaped, which was fun, and there were children outside looking for Easter eggs, and it was real festive. Today, I feel a kind of energy of commemoration. It's the Jewish New Year begins tonight, the High Holy Days of Rosh Hashanah. And we may get rain, so some respite from the terrible sunshine. Anyway, it feels like a new beginning, perhaps of a time of reflection. I want to start by explaining what we're doing a little bit. Frank and I have known each other for 30 years. Now, you are higher than I am.
I have been most of my life.
And our relationship has gone through a lot of transformations itself, and an enduring fact of it is that we tend to have kind of regular phone conversations. Frank lives in L.A., and we talk about our spiritual well-being, or lack thereof. And so it's an interesting and kind of peculiar friendship. And some months ago, we thought, wouldn't it be fun to actually just start doing these conversations in public? So what you're going to hear today is how we talk to each other. And we're going to be talking about forgiveness. Now, I want to say, I'll introduce Frank a little further by saying that I met him after he had gotten into recovery from one of his addictions, but before he came to what I think we both would agree it was his real bottom, which is the thing that's chronicled in the movie, and his transformation from that. As fate or the gods or goddess would have it, the people who made that movie included some who knew me from work I had done in Landmark Education in New York. So go figure. And at the time, we weren't much in touch. I am constantly inspired by Frank's frankness. I'm inspired by your clarity, your willingness to open your heart. I'm inspired in particular by your adeptness at listening to others, and especially me, when we're talking. I get a lot out of that. You know, having a good listener is a fantastic experience.
Well, thank you, Beverly. There in the circles in which we travel, one of the things that they say is you will come across people you normally would not meet. You know, is that how they say it? Something like that. Anyway, like, there's no reason in the world, you know, on paper that I should be friends with Beverly, but here we are. And I think that one of the things when we, well, actually, just where we really, the first time we met, Beverly had just finished writing a book. She had come back from Bosnia, and she wrote a book on the atrocities that were going on there during the war with the ethnic cleansing, particularly the atrocities that were being imposed upon women. And when I met her, we were in Washington, D.C. I was living in Washington, D.C., and she was doing a book tour, and she was under threat by the people she was exposing in the Bosnian War. And so she was flanked by bodyguards, and I thought, wow, who is this cute blonde surrounded by these bodyguards? I was very intrigued, you know. And so we started talking, and we became friends. And one of the things that my experience with Beverly is that when we started talking, I had a great deal of respect for her because she was an author, and she had a lot of letters behind her name. But and I was always very, very, you know, that was always very important to me, and because I didn't have any letters, except for NYPD. but we would have these conversations, it was part of my journey of feeling better about myself. And I thought, this woman that I held in very high regard, and she was very, I held her, and she was like, I gave her this auspicious place in my consciousness. But she would talk to me like a peer. And at one point, I mentioned that to her. I was like really grateful that we were having this conversation. And I told her about this incident where I was invited to this really nice place with Edgar Mitchell and a few other really important people to discuss the aspects of my film. And I was telling Beverly about this, and she said, "It's time to take your place at the table." And she is instrumental in that journey that I have in discovering my self-worth by virtue of her just giving me the equal amount of respect that I was giving her. Anyway, thanks. And I'm also like, she's one of those people like that, you know, a personal trainer in the gym, what they're supposed to do is, the two primary functions of a personal trainer is to make sure that you can come back tomorrow, in other words, safely engage in whatever thing you're going to do. And the other thing is to help you transcend your perceived limitations. And then we have people in our lives that, if we're lucky, that do that. And Beverly does that for me spiritually and intellectually. She helps me transcend my perceived limitations. It's really quite wonderful. And I think the reason she calls it a peculiar friendship. I think it's not peculiar. It's peculiar maybe so much because it's not much of the norm. I don't know. I didn't think. Of course, everything about us is good, honey. But anyway, it's not peculiar. It's just unusual because there's a lot of depth and texture to it. Anyway.
There you go. Thank you.
I warmed it up for you.
No, I warmed it up for you first. Okay, now I'm wondering, should we try to talk to each other or just talk about what we've already been thinking about?
I think we should just let it organically unfold. How it
like is. Life.
Sort of.
So, just as we both had an intuition the first time we planned to do this, that what needed to be spoken about was transformation. This time also, we both knew before we spoke to each other about it that what needed to be discussed was forgiveness. So this is working in our lives sort of in tandem. And in our conversations about what we would say today, we decided we would start by defining forgiveness. And I made up some kind of etymologies of the word forgiveness. Forward givingness. The quality of giving something forward in the world. If I forgive you, we can both move forward. We're not trapped in that dynamic of blame and resentment and fear. Or we could say forgiveness is giving something, the quality of giving something for. So I have a resentment against you, and I'm exchanging that for a giving. I'm exchanging my resentment for something I can give. Well, who am I giving it to? You may not care at all whether I have a resentment against you, although I wake up with it every morning. So perhaps the gift is a gift I give myself. Now, you might not pass your PhD orals with these etymologies, but I find them helpful. Say something.
Say something. I got to be careful because I slip into stories all the time because my brain is like, I have this, what's left of it is thinks of everything associatively, and I think of my experience with forgiveness, like, yeah. I didn't think about it the way you think about it, because you got to,
Go for it.
But I think about, and Wayne Dyer actually talks about this too, like, because he had a really rough childhood, and his father abandoned him, father was an alcoholic, and all the attendant things that happened with that, and a series of foster homes, and I didn't have that, that experience, but there was I had a lot of training. Like, I think that life, like, sometimes I think of life as panning for gold, right? Like those movies where these guys are in this very tough environment and they're standing in cold water and they got this mesh pan and they're in the mud and they're looking for gold. And I thought, when I think about my past, that's what it's like. It was like really muddy. But what I'm supposed to do now is find the nuggets of gold in that mud. And that's where my training is. And so I can legitimately accuse and indict a lot of people in my life. I could accuse and indict the Catholic Church. I could accuse and indict my violent father. I could accuse and indict my histrionic mother, all that stuff. But I think, when I think now, and there's this beautiful book that you gave me last night that talks about this, which I forgot the name of because...
Joan Chittister's book on aging.
Yes. The 80s and the 60s were really rough. Anyway, so I started thinking about that, and I've been... It's a training for forgiveness. All these things are training for forgiveness. And I realized, and I remember there were times when I work with people, and there was this one individual, and two individuals in particular, that I was talking about forgiveness. They had an incident. One of them was an adultery, and the other one was something else. And when I started talking about forgiveness, not only were they resistant, one person I thought was going to get out of the chair and get violent. Like, they were so attached to that resentment that, they can't forgive. And then finally said, well, I'll forgive, but I'll never forget. And I said, well, nobody's asking you to forget. I'm just suggesting that maybe you remember it differently. It's the same thing, but remember it differently. Just put a different value on it and a perspective. And so, an example of that, I thought about my father, who was I'm the first born in an Italian family, which is a very auspicious place to be, right? Like the golden boy. But my father really treated me like that was just a terrible accident that should never have entered his life. And at one point I thought, I always resented he didn't love me the way I wanted him to love me and all those, all that stuff. And I thought, at one point, when I got older and I started practicing these principles, and I thought, wow, man, what must have happened to my father that he would treat me like that? And then I started thinking about it along those lines, which didn't make what he did okay. It didn't, it wasn't like his behavior was acceptable. But I understood it in a different way. And it was really interesting. I started to be able to love him without an expectation of how he should love me back. And I became the parent, And I think it freed me. And what that is to me, is the portal to compassion.
Yeah. So, as you know, I had my first real experience of active forgiveness when I was in my late 40s and had entered recovery from an addiction. And part of the spiritual program associated with this recovery was that I should rid myself of resentments by praying for the people I resented. Well, I had seen the suggestions in this program, and I thought that I would pick and choose a few. But this one about... praying for the people I resented. Okay, I could perhaps do that, although I didn't pray because I didn't have a higher power. And my list was rather small because there were some people who had done such terrible things to me that there was no way I could pray for them. Well, two things happened thanks to a friend. I was explaining all this to him. And he said, okay, Beverly, you've had it with God and all this, and you don't have a higher power, but from where you're sitting, we were on the phone, can you see your kitchen sink? Yeah. Well, does it work? Yeah. What's he getting at? You know? Well, why don't you choose your kitchen sink as your higher power? And I thought, my God, that's sacrilegious. And I said, what do you mean, my kitchen sink? And he said, Beverly, it works and you don't. And that's how I got started back to, you know, a transcendental sense of divinity, which is the basis of my...
Well, a leaky sink to that. I mean, pretty good, huh?
Yeah. So then I started praying to the sink. No. Then I said, well, I can't pray. Maybe the sink has more power than I do, but I can't pray. I can't pray for this person who has done me so wrong. And my friend said, well, Beverly, could you pray that he gets what he deserves? What an idea. Yeah, I can pray for that. And he said, well, do that. And so that's how I started praying for him. And after about a week, I realized, believe it or not, I mean, it was really fun to pray because I knew what he deserved, right? After about a week of this activity, I started to get the sneaking suspicion that, in fact, I didn't know what he deserved. And after another week, I started to wonder, gee, I wonder if he suffers from the same addiction I do. I wonder what his life is like. What's it like to wake up and walk around in his shoes? And the resentment didn't go away entirely at that moment, but it went away about 95%. And over the years working on it, I'm happy to say I don't carry that around with me anymore. So we do have some other things to talk about beyond our individual experiences of this. Do you want to mention some?
Well, if I may tag on that, You know, because there's as human beings, I think we like our lives to be like a nice bento box, you know, like a 1950s movie, right? The bad guy always gets caught, the good guy always gets the girl, and they live happily ever after, whatever that means. And I also engaged in the same practice. I was getting divorced in early recovery. I was in the process of separation and all that stuff. They also say don't make any major decisions in your first year, but you don't really have to. They will be made for you. And so I was very resentful to my ex-wife, and they told me this two-week thing, and I kind of dug it, although 2 weeks seemed like a long time. Mine took 2 years, and it took 2 years because, you know, well, obviously I was attached to the resentment, but the point is that I was sitting in a meeting. I can remember as clear as day, I was sitting in a meeting, and all of a sudden, 2 years later, I realized, it's like I woke up and I thought, oh my God, you know, that resentment was gone. And it felt similar to being on the train and realizing you left your briefcase in the waiting room, right? It was like I was looking for it. It was like I felt like something was missing. And I realized that these resentments weren't just like this. They were a part of my identity. It wasn't just because somebody A did something to B. It was they had become part of the narrative of my daily existence. And so letting go of this wasn't just like letting go. It's like people talk about it like pulling out a splinter, which it is. But it was so much deeper than that. It was how I saw the world and how I saw myself in relation to the world. And to re-identify myself. And every time I let go of one of these things, I had to re-identify myself. And re-identify how I showed up. Anyway, so what are we doing?
I'll do it. So, as we were talking this morning, we realized that Yom Kippur begins this evening. I'm sorry, Rosh Hashanah, sorry. Which includes, then there will be Yom Kippur also. And as it happens, last year I celebrated these holidays, holy days, completely with a Jewish friend and got a lot out of it. But one thing I learned, and I want to kind of steer our conversation about forgiveness into this perspective, I noticed that everyone in the choir on Yom Kippur, well, first of all, this holiday gives everyone an opportunity to erase all debts and promises and start with a clean slate, right? That's probably a real undertaking, but it has to do with forgiveness. It is forgiveness, forgiveness of everything, including financial debts. And then, of course, there's a very somber memorialization, remembrance of those who have died. Well, the choir wore white clothes that day, as did many people in the congregation. And I asked my friend, why are people wearing white clothes? And he said, well, I don't know. You know, I think it's about, you know, cleansing, wiping the slate clean, starting off with a sense of purity or something. But, you know, being a participant observer in all this, I was reading the notes in the prayer book, and I discovered another reason. These white clothes don't so much symbolize purity as they stand for burial shrouds. Burial shrouds. So the idea of wearing white traditionally at this time is to remember the transitory nature of this particular human experience. So if I put the importance of forgiveness in the context of my own mortality, I get a little bit of a nudge to forgive sooner rather than later. Shakespeare in King Lear has a character say, "You must bear with me. Pray you now forget and forgive. I am old and foolish." So, yes, time for me to be forgiving, but also to be forgiven and ask for forgiveness. And many of the conversations we've had about this brought us to think about instances in which we are saying, I'm sorry. You know, so we're asking for forgiveness.
Well, one of the things I had to learn what it really meant to forgive. You know, like, because some people, one way of looking at it is like you're from an egocentric kind of thing. You know, like in Schindler's List, when Schindler's telling the camp commandant, like he's trying to get him to stop killing people, and he goes, you know, there's more power in forgiving, you know, and absolving people, like forgiving people, and he toys with it for a while, but he can't do it. He just can't sustain it. And I have done some things in my life that I still regret, and probably will always. And I think that that's the other thing is that, you know, I think remorse, there's a healthy remorse. You know, there's that kind of neurotic, self-serving, self-pitying remorse. But then there's like remorse that I believe is healthy. I think if there's certain things that if I'm just, you know, sort of flippant about them, kind of makes me a sociopath, you know? And the road, my experience with forgiveness also is what I've learned is that I can't forgive me until I forgive you. You know, and that's really what we're aiming for, you know, going home. You know, when I can forgive myself, I can be home. And I think, you know, this this sort of spiritual nomadic thing that so many people are engaged in, like going to Nome, Alaska or something spiritually, just to, you know, going to the caves and going, and, you know, all that stuff, just to go inward. It's like I've been a spiritual nomad all along, just, you know, having to face the reality of who I am inside and atone for those things so that I can be at one with myself and at one with you. But I struggled with that a great deal. I couldn't forgive myself. And, you know, that was my process. I had to learn how to forgive you first. And of course, there's an argument to that. There's always a paradox, and there's always somebody with ready for an argument to your point of view, but that's my experience, you know.
Well, I'd like to, on that note, tell a story from Bosnia. So Anne mentioned that I spent time in, and still do, in Bosnia and Croatia during and after the war. And I remember vividly, in the year 2000, so the war had been over for a bit, going with a friend who ran an NGO and with a writer friend of mine from Norway. We were interviewing girls and women all over the country to see how they had survived and what mechanisms or beliefs or practices had enabled them to survive. And now we were in northern Bosnia, in central Bosnia, but in part a village that was in what became the Bosnian Serb Republic, according to the Dayton Accord. So it was predominantly Serb population. And all the houses that had belonged to Bosnians had been entirely destroyed. And our NGO friend had a particular couple there that he was friendly with and trying to help. And we went to see them, and they were living in the dirt-floored basement of their home, which no longer existed. And they were waiting for international aid so that they could perhaps rebuild. And, pardon me, the woman was a tiny person, frail looking. And she and her husband introduced us to their neighbor, who, by contrast, was a big, robust woman who smoked a pipe. And this big, robust woman had already received the ingredients for mixing concrete, which is what she was doing, to rebuild her house. And she was drying fruit and drying tomatoes, and she was being extremely provident. And she too was living in her basement, but she had a bunk bed, and she was drying these peppers and tomatoes on one level and sleeping on the other, and she had her pipe and her cement mixer and robust. Okay. Well, my friend from Norway, a woman, Susan Schwartz Sinstad, and I spent quite a bit of time alone with these two women that afternoon. And we had a wonderful time. And I'm just going to take a minute to describe that. Yeah. So they were dressed with head coverings and the pantaloons of the peasants. And we were interested in their clothes. And so they demonstrated that these pantaloons were like one length of fabric pulled up and tied to make legs, you see. And then the head coverings, they said, oh, you want to see what's under? Well, yeah. And now imagine, we're in the basement of this house. The floor, it's a dirt floor. The lighting is extremely poor. Everything is dusty and brown and gray, and their clothes are old and faded, and now they start to take off their head coverings, and suddenly this bright orange color invades the scene because they have both henna'd hair, bright orange hair, And it was amazing. And they laughed at our reaction. So we got to be friendly in this kind of women's world way. And even though we didn't have much time together, we finally got to asking them, well, you know, we knew that the robust woman had lost her husband. He had just disappeared one night. But she knew that Serb neighbors down the street had killed him. Now, mind you, this is after the war, so everyone's back in the village. These women are now going to have to rebuild their civic life with the people who did these things. They're going to have to set up the volunteer fire department. They're going to have their PTA meetings. Well, these women were older. They probably didn't go to PTA yet. But imagine what destiny was asking of them. Imagine. Imagine that. So we were talking about that. And I said, well, why do you think this happened? And they both said, it happened because we didn't pray enough. I was so shocked. And I thought this was terrible self-blame. We didn't pray enough. Well, they didn't seem particularly upset about the fact they hadn't prayed enough. They were living in dire circumstances now and had witnessed terrible things. And then I understood that when they took the responsibility upon themselves for what had happened, they were giving themselves implicitly tremendous agency. We could have prevented it, and we didn't. So the next thing they talked about was how they forgave the perpetrators. How can you forgive the perpetrators? Well, Allah tells us we must. How can you do this? Well, we just do. We forgive them. We forgive them. And it wasn't about forgetting. How could they forget? But now, because they forgave them, they could rebuild the life of the village. Well, then, we were talking about forgiveness, and they told me, we forgive ourselves as well for not praying enough. What a journey. It happened because we didn't pray enough. We forgive them. And we forgive ourselves. That was a huge lesson to take away from there. And not everyone in Bosnia was that adept at forgiving. You ready?
Actually, no. That was... we were discussing earlier the also a few years ago, I remember the incident where this guy went into an Amish schoolhouse and shot all these children. Later on, this guy that went into an African-American church and shot a bunch of people, and how in both instances the news media was looking for venom, and both, you know, the Amish people said, we've already forgiven him. We've already forgiven him, which was disappointing to the news media. But you think about what courage that takes to do that. I couldn't. I mean, I'm a parent. I can't even imagine what that's like. But when I think about the resentment and what Beverly just talked about, the resentment is like ink in the water. You know, it just permeates your entire life. It's like being in litigation. You know, you wonder if this is the right tie to wear outside in case anybody sees you or something. It just permeates your consciousness. It's not an easy thing to do. The spiritual life is not, you know, it's not for the faint of heart. It really takes, in my experience, it takes a tremendous amount of courage. And sometimes I have to be a witness to somebody to experience the humility of what that, you know, and realize the absence of my humility when I see somebody like that, like I think, oh my God, I don't think of them as weak. You know, it's somehow perceived as weakness. Forgiving is like a weakness. In the Course in Miracles, one of the things I love that it says, in my defenselessness, my safety lies. And if you look at pictures of saints, many of them they're standing there with their palms exposed. They're defenseless. So how do you attack that? You know, how can you, unless you're a sociopath, there's no way you can attack that. But I never had the courage to be with my palms extended. There's always one behind my back in case something happens. But my aspiration, you know, that's what the spiritual life is, and that's what I think this forgiveness piece, it's not a goal, it's not a destination, but an aspiration. You know, it's an aspiration. The St. Francis prayer, whether it's hatred, let me bring love, whether it's darkness, let me bring light, whether it's this, on and on. It's an aspiration, you know. It's not something I accomplish and then I don't got to deal with it anymore. So all of this stuff that we're talking about, to me, is an aspiration, you know. I mean, you think about the cross, right? The last thing Jesus says, right? Forgive them, Father. They know not what they do. The last thing that he did is like, and you think, well, that's an aspiration. There you've been humiliated, physically tortured, and you're about to die, and the last thing you do is forgive these crazy people. It's an aspiration.
So I'm really present to the two sides of forgiveness, forgiving someone else and being forgiven, and how that feels. I want to tell an anecdote about a friend of mine, very accomplished physician. This is 20 years ago, who had met the woman he wanted to marry. And he was in love with her. And she with him, and they were spending a lot of time together. And then one weekend, he went off on some conference, and old behavior set in, and he had a one-night stand. And his fiance found out about this and told him that was it. And he called me to get advice. And He was so full of self-justification. Well, it didn't mean anything. She knows I really love her. This was just, a mistake. On and on and on. And I said, well, how's that working for you? Oh, no, she's really mad. She's not going to take me back. And I said, look, why don't you just ask her to forgive you? I don't know where that thought came. At the time, I wasn't especially well practiced in forgiveness. Well, at that time, I was learning. And it was like this silence. He had never considered this. But he did take responsibility. He quit trying to deny what had happened. He quit trying to deny how it had affected her. He quit trying to blame her for having her own reactions, and he asked her to forgive him. He didn't just say, I'm sorry. He asked her literally, please, can you forgive me? Will you forgive me? And she did. And they got married and have had a very successful marriage. So from that I learned, and many other things, that if I do something harmful to another person, I'm not going to get past first base if I deny, one, that I did it, or two, that it caused harm to the other person. I get to take responsibility and then ask for forgiveness. And then if it comes, and it may not, you can't force it. If it comes, it's just the best gift ever. I wanted to mention two other things. One is the Lord's Prayer. You mentioned the prayer of St. Francis. I have great difficulty with the Lord's Prayer because it says, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, or forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And I always say, Forgive me my trespasses a whole lot better than I forgive those who trespass against me. Please. I want divine, I want the universe to be forgiving of me much more amply than I myself manage to forgive other people. And then I'll have one more thing, but
I'm sorry, but I can't resist this. You know, like the Lord's Prayer was, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. But the bankers even got a hold of that prayer and changed it to, don't step on my lawn. You know, don't trespass. It's like, wow. Because think about how much more powerful it is to forgive a debt. A trespass, what does that even mean? You know, it's like, I got to think about the debt. You don't have to, immediately you know what that means. And I think that it's part of how somehow we've circumvented our responsibility on this grand scale. And, you know, one of the things about forgiveness is that there are techniques that are appropriate to, that facilitate forgiveness. And one of the things that I heard early on that was really striking is, because sometimes, let's say there's a situation where you're only 20% responsible. Let's say, realistically, you're only 20% responsible for this drama. Well, which was what I always try to get percentages in my favor. And this guy says to me, Frankie, if you're only 20% responsible for the situation, you're 100% responsible for your 20%. I said, this spiritual thing, every time I turn around, they close a door on me, And I started, because I thought, oh man, once something goes in your head, it's there. It's like, oh, because that's the thing about truth. Truth is irrefutable. There's no argument to the truth. It's just, it, and there's no, you try to make it something else and it can't do it. And I started thinking, it altered the way I approached the whole notion of my transgressions, I was 100% responsible for my 20%. And since I was never good at math, I might have been wrong about the 20%. Yeah. Because that long division thing always eluded me, So I realized some of the percentages don't matter because we're playing a much bigger game than I have the capacity to understand. I'm 100% responsible for what I did. And that's, I think that's also the key to forgiving yourself. It's like just recognizing what you did. And may I just, I get this little thing. I see the Chinese, people use animals a lot for metaphors about human life. I like the supermarket. Right? So, I don't like going to the supermarket when there's a lot of people there. So I go late at night. So I go 11 o'clock, right? You go into the supermarket at 11 o'clock at night, and it's a mess, right? They're taking stuff off the shelves, there's boxes all over the place, you can't get your wagons through the aisles, and it's a complete mayhem, right? And then, it's a little hard to get what you want, and you look at stuff coming off the shelves and stuff coming on the shelves and people scurrying around, and then you go in at 9 o'clock in the morning and it looks like it never happened. And I started thinking, that's kind of how life is. When you're doing this process of inventory and looking at your side of the street, and it's really scary and it's really messy and it's hard to navigate the way you used to navigate. But when you do the right thing, the next morning there's a clarity to it, and that's how I see this thing about working on your stuff. It's like the supermarket at 11 o'clock, and it looks crazy, but then you have but the people that are there, they know what's going on, right? They're not freaked out by all this. This is just their gig. And those people that are there are my Sherpas, in my life. These are the Beverlys and my brother and people that help me recalibrate my compass. I don't know why I was imposed. I just felt I needed to tell that story.
Yeah, that was a good story, wasn't it?
You inspired that.
Plus, I got to find out I'm a Sherpa. I love it. So I have a couple more things to say, one of which is, in the Times, New York Times, some days ago, here's a review by Michiko Kakutani of a book called Mishling by a woman named Affinity Konar. And this book, which I haven't read, I just read the review, it's a novel about a set of twin sisters who were experimented on in Mengele's terrible death camps. And the review, well, let me just read a bit. The girls, inseparable in their past life, after the war, find themselves growing apart from each other, fiercely devoted to one another, but broken in different ways by Mengele's hideous experiments, which damage Stasha's hearing and sight and leave Pearl in a cage, her ankle snapped and her feet smashed. Mengele, who alternates displays of avuncular concern with chilling sadism, seems to take pleasure in watching what effect separation will have on the sisters. This is the novel. The second half of Mischling largely takes place after the advance of the Soviet army and the liberation of Auschwitz. Pearl is taken care of by Miri, a Jewish doctor whom Mengele forced to work as his assistant, while Stasha finds herself wandering with a friend named Felix through a blasted, war-torn landscape that can't help but remind the reader of Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Survival, simply finding food, water, and shelter, is paramount. But Stasha becomes increasingly obsessed with hunting down Mengele and exacting revenge. Such plot points can seem melodramatic and contrived, and Ms. Konar's prose occasionally eddies into self-consciously pretty writing. Quote, "For 8 months we were afloat in amniotic snowfall, two rosy mittens resting on the lining of our mother." These passages call to mind the philosopher Theodore Adorno's warning of the dangers of making art out of the Holocaust through aesthetic principles or stylization, he argued. The unimaginable ordeal is transfigured and stripped of some of its horror. But these doubts are steamrollered by Ms. Konar's ability to powerfully convey the experiences of her heroines, their resourcefulness and will to survive, their resilience and faith in a future even in the face of extermination, and Pearl's remarkable determination to embrace forgiveness. "Forgiveness," quote, "did not remove my pain or blunt my nightmares," she says. "It was not a new beginning. It was not in the slightest an end. My forgiveness was a constant repetition, an acknowledgement of the fact that I still lived. It was proof that their experiments, their numbers, their samples, was all for naught. I remained. A tribute to their underestimations of what a girl can endure. In my forgiveness, their failure to obliterate me was made clear." So her forgiveness is a victory for her. A victory for her. Do you want to react to that?
I was thinking of a story I heard from Marianne Williamson about a friend of hers that passed away, but was had been a victim of the camps. And what was noteworthy, particularly noteworthy about this woman, was her attitude. She was always happy. She had a really buoyant approach to life. And when she was asked how she was able to transcend her experience in the camps into this, you know, this way of being that she was exhibiting, and she said, "Hitler got 2 years of her life. he wasn't getting a minute more. And I thought, wow. And I think it sort of speaks to that, and to me, like, that the power of forgiveness and the power of the human spirit in the face of these adversities. I mean, I never faced anything to that extent, but I know what it's like to have to free my heart. And it just seems to me that, you know, a big part of the journey, and, you know, forgiveness is one of those components that enables me to unveil or to melt the ice around my heart. And sometimes that evokes tears because it's painful. And it's, I think that the courage to face that anguish in order to achieve a degree of transcendence is where the courage lies.
So what I've been hearing in our time together today are the several effects of forgiveness. So one, it benefits the community, because it enables for a new beginning, something that is not going to be based on a foundation of resentment. Two, it benefits me as the person doing the forgiving, because I get rid of this ton of bricks I've been carrying around that interrupts my sleep and makes me grouchy. And I'm determined not to be a grouchy old lady. I'm determined, yeah, that prime time will be pleasant. But I'm now mindful, so it's of great benefit to me. It benefits the community. It benefits me. It benefits the person I'm forgiving if they're aware that they're being forgiven. But now my mind has landed on something I heard once that gives me still another realm of what forgiveness makes possible. And that is a realm of abstraction and utter generosity in the universe. And the saying is this: forgiveness is the perfume the violet emits toward the heel of the boot that has crushed her. Forgiveness is the perfume the violet emits toward the heel of the boot that has crushed her. The violet asks nothing. The heel of the boot may not notice, but the air is now sweet. So, Mark Twain said that. Thank you. Mark Twain, we've got an editor of the Mark Twain papers here. I bet you recognize that. Oh, my goodness. So, why don't we invite...
Yes, indeed.
Contributions, yes. Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I thought I was coming to a goddess talk. And no, well, I believe that everything happens for a reason. And so when I woke up this morning, my muse kept telling me to wear this. And I was like, why? Like, I just couldn't understand why. And now I understand. Because to me, purple is the color of compassion. And it is associated with... a sacred geometry that I work with that's about transcendence, that compassion is the road to transcendence. And I think in story as well, so I have a story that I want to share. I took a medical intuitive class a couple of years ago, and in that class, you read each other. So the idea is that if you have a health illness, that the source of all physical pain is emotional and spiritually connected. So we were practicing on each other, and this was very out of my comfort zone to go to a class like this. I was trained as a pharmacist, So I worked with drugs. But in the class, the woman that was reading me was like, your father's here. He's behind you. And she was like, do you have any physical ailments? And I said, no, not really. I mean, I have back pain. And the thing is that I've had back pain for 20 years. So it just became one of those things of like, I live with it. I don't consider it a problem, right? It's just I lived with it. And she said, you have anger towards him. You need to forgive him. And I was like, but he's dead. Like, I was like, okay, I forgive him. And she's like, no, you really need to forgive him. And so I do what I do, what I normally do, which is I go right to Google and I typed in, how do I authentically forgive? And I really believe that Google has like a direct connection to the cosmos. Because my very first experience with it was I actually Googled, how do I know God? Because well, that's another story. But anyways, it works somehow, at least it does for me. And but you have to listen, because I think when you ask a question, you get answers, and they don't always look the way that you expect them to look. So the way that it looked for me was Deepak Chopra kept on ending, like showing up in my inbox about a meditate, like 21-day meditation thing. So I was like, I wanted to meditate, so I was like, fine, I'm going to do it. And day 4 was forgiveness. And we were taken to a conversation. We had to imagine someone, like a cloud, and someone's face coming through. And, I mean, you don't know who it's going to be. For me, at least, I didn't know. And it was my father, not surprising. And I was taken back to a conversation. You're taken back to a conversation with this person. And I was taken to an emergency room when I was 18 years old, when I got into a car accident and I completely totaled my car with my two best friends in it. And when my dad showed up at the emergency room, his very first question to me was, how fast were you going? And I had no idea, but the back pain started from that day, me thinking that it was physical crash. I relived that conversation and I basically said to him, I'm so scared. Like, I'm so scared. And his response back to me was, I'm 100 times more scared than you. I just don't know how to express it. The next day, I never had back pain again. 20 years. I mean, I had 2 herniated discs, chiropractors, physical therapists. The amount of massage that my dad died, I had shingles, and I had so much back pain that I had to have massage therapists like almost come every day. I mean, that's how much I've been suffering with it. And I think the reason why I'm called to share this story with you is that I believe that sometimes we hold on to things and we don't even know it, because our automatic is to not blame, is to actually not. Like, my culture is very much, like, my mind was, I love you, I can't be angry at you. That was where I went. And so for me, my forgiveness journey has been about letting myself actually feel the depth of those feelings. And feeling it and reliving it and reframing it, sharing the things that I never got to share. And that has created so much space in my life. So thank you.
Let's go ahead.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When I heard the thing about forgiveness, I thought, oh shit, I don't want to stay for this.
Girl, all right. I love you already.
I have wasted too many years hating my mother for the beatings I had as a teenager. And as a result, my task or my commitment to myself and her in the other world, wherever she is to forgive her. But it is a very difficult, long process. I am a writer. And when my coach said, I want a piece in her voice, so the piece will start, my name is Maria. She came from a village in Greece. And she was an immigrant. And as such, I suffered the results of that But it's as if I spent a lifetime loving, hating this woman. Mm-hmm. And what a waste. What an absolute waste. I also am in recovery. So, boy, am I on step one so many times with this one. So I'm really glad for the topic, because for those who say, you know, on my deathbed I'll forgive, you know, or please forgive me, I forgive you, goodbye, and so forth, it doesn't work that way. And I don't want to live my life carrying that corpse on my back. And that's why I continue to write. And I thank you, really humbly thank you for the topic, because it's so important to our life,
thank
to mine.
You.
Thank you. Thank you.
You want to comment before you move on?
Yeah, I have something to say. Thank you so much to both of you for sharing your personal experiences of forgiveness. I'm just struck by how deeply the scars of in this culture of immigration go. And it sensitizes me to the deep scars of being a refugee. You know, it's not quite the same thing, but the shifts of culture, the having to learn new language, I cannot imagine what it was like for my parents who came from Sweden. I cannot imagine it, but when I want to push the compassion button for them, I try to. I try to imagine what it feels like to say goodbye to your mother, to your father, to, you know, everything you know, not knowing whether you'll ever see it again or not. That was what I wanted to say. We have Barbara now.
Just a quick one. 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Sicily, which is where my parents are from. And at one point, I went to this town called Messina, which is, there's a ferry that goes to the mainland. It's a short ride. And it was, the sun was setting. And I'm on, it's a ferry, it was a fairly large boat. There were cars on it and stuff. I'm on the bridge. And as the boat pulls out and starts going, I literally, the beauty of the Mediterranean, the sun setting, the sight of the shore of Sicily was staggeringly beautiful. It literally took my breath away. And I thought, wow, what must it have felt like? Because in immigration is always a push-pull thing. There's something pushing you away and pulling you toward. But to leave that level, that amount of beauty, to get into the docks of the west side of Manhattan and to go to grimy Brooklyn, I mean, it's just, I can't imagine what that was like. You know, and it was a beauty that I had. It was a stunningly beautiful. And to go from that to Brooklyn, even though the Dodgers were there at the time, you know, I mean, really, it's just. And so that kind of stuff softens your heart. I mean, this is what we're talking about, is heart opening, you know, things to do to open up your heart and to soften your heart. And so, anyway, so.
Barbara.
Well, I've been dealing with this one for a long time. There are two people who always come to mind when we talk about forgiveness. One was somebody in a work situation, and one was my first husband. Both of them made the situation so difficult I could not stay in it. And for a long time, I was very resentful, very angry. But I'm now grateful and have been for a long time, because in each case, they pushed me out of a situation that was never going to work for any length of time and got me to move on. In the work situation, I got another whatever kind of job. I'd been in a situation, in a work place where I had helped start an organization. And this woman came on the board and just made life miserable. I went back to graduate school and went on into a whole different world, which has been wonderful. And of course, in the marriage, it was like, wasn't going to work. And I've told people, I'm so grateful that he was as difficult as he was, because it made it much easier for me to leave it. So I went from, I don't know where the forgiveness came in, but I went from resentment to being grateful. Maybe I skipped that other one, the forgiveness, but I don't know. But it feels a lot better.
Any other questions?
What I have is not to offer, it's more to ask a question than to offer a story.
Great.
I'm involved with a black woman and I, so a black woman and a white woman. We are gathering, inviting people to come together and get into dialogue about racism and the struggles we have with race and culture, not understanding about race and culture. What I've just met up with in myself right now, what I'm in a pretty frequent struggle with is forgiving myself for my white privilege. So this is a whole cultural thing that I was born into that I perpetuate just by my very birth, by my who I am. I perpetuate and participate in white privilege, which I don't know how to let go of and don't know if I could, but anyway. So I'm thinking about a whole cultural thing that has history and yet impacts all of us in our daily lives. What's going on racially in this country right now has, you know, the roots in slavery. When you talk about immigration, then you think about, oh my God, you know, this country, the huge impact of slavery that is continually perpetuated. And for many of us, it has to do with what I'm struggling with.
Thank you for the question. I think the question is, how do I forgive myself for this innate privilege I have in this culture? And I think for me, the pathway would be the same with any other issue that I need to forgive myself for. So taking responsibility for it, I mean, which you're doing, you know, you're not denying that you have white privilege in a racist society. You're saying, I do. And it sounds to me as if you're acting in the world in such a way to create a situation in which such privilege won't exist. And the rest is inner work, I think. I can't tell you how to do it, but I might suggest that it's, and you probably know this already, very important to avoid any assumption that the woman you're working with should show you how. It's not her job to assuage the guilty conscience. You know, it was Marx who said, those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. So forgiveness is this itself is a path that we need to clear away of resentment, but not of memory. Something like that. We need to clear it of resentment, but not memory. So working without resentment in order to create a situation where the horrible poisons of racism will no longer exist. We've recently been very dramatically reminded of how important this is in this culture. So thank you for your share and your question. I'm no expert.
I'm definitely no expert. However, what I heard initially was what I heard was, it sounded like you were a perpetrator. And This is, you were born into this, you know, you're, whatever the situation that you're in. And I think, I don't know about you, but my brain always finds something about myself to condemn. I always have something in myself to condemn. And it seems that, I don't know if that's the most effective way of approach to what you're, my feeling is that you're in a position to be an example. And you're in a position, rather than, you know, like, why, John Lennon, I was just reading about John Lennon, and one of the struggles he had was when he came into his fame and fortune, feeling guilty about having money when people didn't. Right? So, he didn't do anything wrong, he just has all this bread, but the thing to do is, like, how do I live my life for the greater good? And I think that that's the answer, really. How do you live your life? I'm not you, but how would, if, you know, if I were in a position of privilege and all those things you said, that, okay, how, what is it that I can do that will be, whatever decision that I make, how is this for the greater good? And if I'm in a position where, you know, I have a flexibility to be able to do that, you know, because I don't have to work two jobs, well, you know, that's a good thing. You know, so anyway, it's, let yourself off the hook is what I'm trying to say. You know, give yourself a break.
You know, it reminds me a little bit of, this may be a stretch, but some of the experiences I had in Bosnia when I was meeting women who had had extremely dreadful experiences. And I always had to remember that I was learning about problems that were not mine. And I had my own stories and experiences of violence and even sexual violence, okay. But this was not about me. It's not about me. And, okay, secondary trauma, all that, I'll deal with it later. Right now, it's not about me. So there's a societal dynamic at work here, and we each have a place in that. And I don't know. I sometimes say I just have to give it to God. I just have to give it up. Give it to God. And I don't mean to be trite. It's not always easy to do that. But if I can, then I'm back in the present working with my friend to end racism. Or whatever.
Last question.
While I think that forgiving can be great, there's the issue of forgetting. Forgetting, does one forgive and then forget what happened? Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no, because there are a lot of people who try and use you. And if you forget, such as in an abusive relationship, that this person is going to repeat what happened or use me again or hit me again, you're in trouble. So there's a big difference between forgiving and forgetting. And what are your thoughts on that?
We touched on that earlier. I think one of the reasons forgiveness is such a resistance to forgiveness is I think forgiveness gets a really bad rap, that it's associated with weakness and the whole turning of the other cheek. What do you mean turning the other cheek so it can hit the other side? No, turn the other cheek so it frees my heart, but it doesn't mean that I'm going to let it happen again or that I think it's okay. In my experience, when I repeated a situation, getting into an abusive situation, it was because I hadn't learned the lesson yet. When I learned the lesson, then that the drama stopped. But what I said earlier was I remember it differently. Nobody's asking, you know, I'm not going to forget in the sense like forget so that I can let it happen again. I'm just remembering it from a different perspective, and it doesn't mean that what that person did in this case, like say my father with the violence and all that, doesn't mean that what he did was okay or that it was right. But I'm remembering it now as a mature man. And looking at it in a way that is compassionate to him and myself.
Yeah, thank you so much for this. We must remember the Holocaust. We must remember the genocide of the Armenians. We must remember the genocide in Bosnia, the genocide of the Cathars. We must work against genocide. But in order to do that, we have to work also on forgiving the perpetrators who whose lives that have been ruined also by their behavior. And that's a very, very difficult task. So forgiving but not forgetting. You know, when children are abused, they generally don't have the capacity to leave the abusive situation. So that's going to take a lot of forgiveness muscle when they are adults. But if as an adult I'm in an abusive situation, then the first step is always I take responsibility for my part in it. My part in it may just be simply that I keep showing up. Well, I can turn the other cheeks, plural, and walk away. Get it? Yeah, I can walk away. I don't have to stay. I can find a way out. And many of us have done that. So, yeah, that's the bottom line. I mean, we want to encourage in ourselves and each other behaviors that are at the very least not harmful and at the best are compassionate and loving. So, not forgetting what happened, remembering it as something to avoid, to heal, to transform, but also forgiving so that we can engage in those positive activities. Thank you so much for being here. It looks like we're coming.